Hey, my name's Otis Gray, host of the Daily Book Club, a daily podcast where I read wonderful old books one chapter at a time. Simple as that. Whether you want to get engaged and lost in a fascinating story that has stood the test of time, or just relax to a good book, listen to the Daily Book Club to get wrapped up or unwind during your day. We'll read classic stories like Pride and Prejudice, The Enchanted April, The Wind in the Willows, beautiful stories all told from start to finish. And you can even do a real book club. Tune into the Daily Book Club Discord and discuss the readings with other book club listeners. However you want to listen, it's your choice. Subscribe to the Daily Book Club on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and everywhere else. New episodes every single day. So sit back, relax, and get lost in the Daily Book Club.
This episode of Amateur Traveler is sponsored by DK Eyewitness Travel Guides. These colorful guidebooks are filled with great information and are one of my favorite guidebooks. I have 25 of them right here on my bookshelf. Learn more at dk.com. Amateur Traveler, episode 496. Today, the Amateur Traveler talks about trains to nowhere, roads that go nowhere, roads that go somewhere in the middle of nowhere, and the largest national park in the United States as we go to remote Alaska. Welcome to the Amateur Traveler. I'm your host, Chris Christensen. I'd like to welcome back DK Eyewitness Travel Guides as a sponsor. We'll be talking more about them later. And then I'd also like to call your attention at the end of this episode. I'm going to tell you about a survey that I need your help with to get some demographics. I'm working with a new company to help sell some ads for the show to help support the work that we do. But now let's talk about remote Alaska. I'd like to welcome back to the show Sherry Ott, coming to us for what we decided is the fifth appearance on the Amateur Traveler from ottsworld.com, and come to talk to us about Northern Alaska. Sherry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me again.
And we decided that Sherry has been on the show talking about Nova Scotia and solo travel around the world as a woman and Costa Brava in Spain and Lebanon.
Yes.
Where are we going this time?
We're going remote to one of my favorite places, remote Alaska.
Okay. And when we say remote versus all of those really urban parts of Alaska, where are we going in Alaska?
Well, I kind of wanted to take you to kind of the remote communities. So we're going to go east to the far east and go to Wrangell St. Elias National Park, which is the home of McCarthy Town. Mm-hmm. We're going to go north up above the Arctic Circle to Coldfoot Camp, and we're going to go far, far west all the way over to Nome, Alaska.
Cool. Excellent. Where should we start?
Let's start in the west. Let's start with Nome.
Okay. Why should we go to Nome?
Well, first, let me just say, I think my goal in even sharing any of this is to see sides of Alaska that most people never see. So, you know, I know that there's a lot of TV shows, they're highly produced. I know a lot of people do cruising in Alaska and they see the beautiful scenery. But what we don't often talk about Alaska is the communities and the people and what you can do in these remote communities and the great stories that are there and how they live in the extremes. So that was my goal in trying to get to these towns. And they're not easy to get to. So that's probably where we can start. Nome is certainly comes from a gold mining history. That's how we probably know of it. It's on the Seward Peninsula, and it is the furthest western town in America. In fact, it's very near the Bering Strait. It's got a population of 3,500 people, which is actually quite a lot compared to these other two towns we're going to talk about.
And when you say the Seward Peninsula, that's, if we were looking at the map of Alaska, it's the peninsula in the middle of the left-hand side.
Yes, that really kind of makes out the, you know, as you go through the Bering Strait.
Right.
And so the Bering Sea, actually Nome is a coastal town in a way, you know, the Bering Sea. And they do have beaches, kind of rough and tumble beaches, but there are beaches.
Not the same as the beaches we talked about recently in San Diego, you're
saying? No. Okay. But they're fascinating. So yeah, it's about a population of 3,500 people. There are currently 13 churches and 9 bars. And as someone told me there, the God is winning out, basically. So I did think that was quite cute. But back, you know, when it was in its heyday during the gold rush, there were 28,000 people, 75 bars, and 2 churches. So you can see it's kind of flipped. But, you know, the first thing to know is that the only way you're going to get to Nome is to fly in. Or I suppose you could, I'd never thought about this, but you could actually do, you know, the Iditarod, because that is where the Iditarod ends. So you could do, you know, mushing if you really wanted to in the winter. But most people are going to fly in. It has a decent airport. In fact, I actually flew in on it was the first time I'd ever taken a combi, I think it's called, a half cargo plane and half passenger plane. Have you ever ridden one of those?
I don't believe I have.
They have them all over Alaska. It's crazy. It's actually really cool. There was only about 20 rows, and it looked like you're in a big jet, but the whole rest of the jet's all cargo. So anyway, you fly in, and it's a town that has 3 roads. It basically has 300 miles of road system, and it has 3 roads, but the roads go nowhere. They just end. They don't connect up.
They don't connect anything to else anything else in the
state. Yeah. Which is actually, I think, why I really, really love Nome. I love that idea that, like, the roads kind of just end and go nowhere. They're also only drivable a few months during the year. The rest of the time, they're closed and not really maintained. They're not really maintained that well anyway. But, you know, there's a lot of things to kind of see and do in Nome. But to me, the real fun is to rent a car or take a tour and get out on those 3 roads and really see what's out there.
And I'm guessing that navigation isn't a real problem.
Oh, no.
Not a lot of choices.
There's only one way to go. Yep. You're not going to miss a turnoff. And there's, you know, as you drive out on the roads too, you also kind of see what it's like. There's a bunch of little cabins. And when I say little cabins, they're little. Like, you know, we were just talking about the tiny house movement. Like, this is probably where the tiny house movement originated, if you ask me. Like, these are just little hunting cabins and stuff like that that the locals in Nome, that's where they escape to. So, you know, they dot the landscape, the tundra, and there are no trees. There are only a few places in Nome where there are trees, and most of it is all just high Arctic tundra. So, pretty fascinating.
Well, you mentioned the Iditarod, and in some ways the Iditarod sort of encapsulates how remote Nome is, because obviously, the race really kind of recreates the route of, for those of us who watch the movie Baldo, or maybe some special on History Channel, basically, in the one winter, they needed to get the medicine to Nome because there was, I think there was an outbreak of typhus or something like that, and they needed to get the medicine, and the only way to do it was with sled dogs. And so they basically are using that route that eventually saved the town of Nome, that the sled dogs made it through, to recreate that as part of the sled dog race. But it really kind of does encapsulate, we're talking about a place that's, you know, especially in the day before air travel or when things were socked in, you were way out there.
Yeah. Yeah. And actually, as you go down Main Street, which is actually called Front Street in Nome, you'll see the wooden arch, the Iditarod finish line. It's right now kind of on the side of the street until the winter when it's all filled with snow and they put it in the middle of Main Street. And that's where the finish is. So it is a big piece of history of that town, along with all the gold rush history, for sure. My best advice is, like I said, those 3 roads to me are really fascinating. So you can do it a couple of different ways. You can rent your own car and drive out on these roads and just explore yourself. I actually happened to get hooked up with a company called Nome Discovery Tours. And when I say company, I say that lightly because it's just one guy.
Okay.
But this one guy is honestly a whole reason to go to Nome by itself. Like, it's Richard Benneville. He's 80 years old and he runs tours in Nome. And he is fascinating. He's an old Broadway actor who escaped a couple of decades ago from New York and a life of alcoholism. And he is honestly one of the most colorful, entertaining characters I've ever met on the road. And I've been traveling a long time. And he just enthralled me with stories. Talk about a good storyteller. So, you know, during the time when you're driving on these roads, which is, you know, can be, I suppose, somewhat boring. There's really no boring moment because he's entertaining you the whole time, telling you about, you know, the history. Sometimes he's singing songs. There's show tune songs. There's all kinds of stuff. But it's a very fun, laid back, way to see the area. So I would highly recommend that. He's a character. But what we did is I did go out with him on two of the roads. I had time to do that. And the first day we went out on, it's kind of northeast, basically. I think it's called the Cougarock Road. But it basically took us to this area that he had told me about called Pilgrim Hot Springs. And so we drove out through the tundra. The mountains were absolutely gorgeous. Big open space. It reminded me a lot of Mongolia, actually. And we turned off that main road and went onto a smaller little road that's barely maintained. And we got out to these hot springs, which is really weird to have in the middle of the Arctic tundra. And of course, by the springs, there were trees, which is also really strange because, as I said, there are no trees on the tundra. So he had talked about it as being one of the only places where you could go in the area and like sit and hear the wind through the leaves of the trees and how much he had missed that, which I thought was a really kind of a interesting thought. But in Pilgrim Hot Springs, it's an old abandoned orphanage, basically. What we did is we just wandered around the buildings. It's really fascinating. The orphanage was created, I think, in 1919, and it was a Catholic mission, basically. And it was built because they needed a place for the kids to go. All the parents were wiped out by the 1918 influenza epidemic in the area. And so they built up these churches and a few like dormitories and stuff like that are now all run down. But it's really fascinating. I mean, it kind of looks like it's a nuclear bomb hit it because there's old rusted bikes out in the grass. And if you like abandoned places like I do, I was in heaven. And just it was such a different environment with the trees. There was an old cemetery there. And then, of course, there's the hot springs. But you have to recognize this is not a tourist site necessarily at all. This is just hot springs out in the middle of nowhere. So you really enter at your own risk. I didn't actually go in the springs, but you could see them. And they definitely looked hot.
Let's take a break here and hear about our sponsor, who is DK Eyewitness Travel Guides. So nice to have them back. I would tell you a little bit about the guidebook to Alaska, but I don't have that one. So let's talk about some other remote place, a place that I'm hoping to get to this year, and that's Australia. Happen to have that guidebook around. And I was looking at the Red Center of Australia, that section that includes Uluru, which I have not yet been to. And the kind of things that grab me when I pick up a DK Eyewitness Guide are the beautiful color photographs of that region. And of course, it has useful things like a map of Alice Springs and then information about the culture. In case of Uluru, it tells you both about the climb and how many people die in the climb every year because it is a strenuous climb, but also the cultural implications with the indigenous people there and why fewer and fewer people are climbing because they're asked not to by the indigenous people. So that's the kind of details, but all wrapped up in these gorgeous, gorgeous color photographs. And that's the reason why I have so many DK Eyewitness Travel Guides. You can find out more information about them by going to DK.com.
It was really fascinating. It was a great drive out there. Also on that drive, I think we saw reindeers. We stopped in and met some reindeer herders, had some tea with them and some jam. And I kind of learned a little bit about the way they lived. And then we came back into town for the evening. I mean, it really takes a full day to go out and come back, even though it's really not that many miles. The roads are pretty rough. The next day, we actually went out to the east on the Council Road, and that was really fascinating. That goes up the coast, kind of along the Bering Sea. And I wanted to go out to see something called the Last Train to Nowhere. As I said, I like abandoned areas, and there's a lot of that in Alaska, and there's this abandoned train system out in the middle of the tundra that has been left to just kind of rust out. And so that was my goal in kind of going out and seeing that. So Richard took me out there. It's fascinating. The engines were actually originally used on the New York City elevated lines back in 1881, and then they were shipped off to Alaska in 1903, and they basically served the miners, and they helped move all the mining from the mountains or from the inland, basically, out to where the railroad was. But a huge Bering Sea storm rushed in 1913, and it flooded the whole area, the tundra, and the train was left for nothing. The tracks were all washed out, and so it's just been there ever since. So it's pretty fascinating. Out there, you can also do a ton of bird watching. Richard is an avid bird watcher, so we were always stopping and looking with the binoculars and trying to figure out the birds. Also, a really cool stop on that road was something called the Safety Roadhouse, which is the last checkpoint on the Iditarod. And it is everything you would expect a roadhouse to be in the middle of nowhere in Alaska. I mean, it was really rough and tumble. You walked in and it was, I mean, there's nothing else out there. The whole thing is like plastered with $1 bills, like wallpaper, all over. Old sofas that look kind of scary in the daylight. You know, there was a bartender there at 1 or 2, whatever, in the afternoon that we stopped in and we talked to. But it was everything you would expect. It was perfect. It would be very interesting to go out there in the evenings. Richard told me that lots of times when the bars close in town, people will race in their cars out to the safety roadhouse and get last call. So I can only imagine what that would be like. But that's kind of the mentality of the town in some ways, too. It's pretty, like I said, it's a rough and tumble town.
Well, and since you were just mentioning the Iditarod, let me expand on and correct what I said about the Iditarod. One is it's older than I thought. It actually predates the thing that I was talking about, which is called the Great Race of Mercy, the serum run to Nome, which happened in 1925. And it was a diphtheria epidemic. I didn't remember what the disease was. And apparently the Iditarod itself has only come to Nome relatively recently. Came in my lifetime in 73.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Huh. That is fascinating. I think it would be really cool to be there and see it, I have to say. I'd love to go back in the winter.
It's a little chilly for me.
I want to go back and do a snowmobiling trip on the Iditarod Trail. I think that would be really interesting.
Interesting. Not a sled dog trip.
Well, that would take a little longer. I'm better at snowmobiling than I am controlling dogs.
Yeah, I mean, the current track, I think the Great Race of Mercy was about 1,000 kilometers, 600-something miles. Now I think it's 1,000 miles.
Wow.
For the race. Just an amazing endurance kind of race.
Yeah, and you know, as you go into these remote communities, you hear about like how we hold football players in such high regard. That's they hold the Iditarod champions in that high regard. It's really fascinating. Yeah. And then, you know, the third road I didn't actually have time to go on, but that's the road north and it's called the Teller Road. And basically you can take that all the way up and visit an old Eskimo village, meet locals there, sit and have lunch with them. And then once again, a bunch of wildlife along the way. And that's the great thing about these roads is you can stop anywhere. It doesn't matter. You can walk out on the tundra, and Richard and I did that a number of times, and you can feel like the really spongy tundra and, you know, see the wildlife and the flowers and stuff that's growing on there. And it was fascinating. And, you know, you can ask Richard anything. He is kind of like the town gossip, too, so you can learn a lot about the town. Everyone knows Richard. Everyone. And then, you know, my recommendation would be, you know, do those things during the day and then come back in and enjoy the town at night, because, well, I was there in the summer, and so it hardly ever gets dark, honestly.
Right.
You know, I think it was maybe got dark around midnight, and I was there in August. So there's plenty of daylight to check out the city. And, you know, in the city, there's a whole bunch of museums. There's a visitor center, very primitive, but it's there. You can learn about the gold dredging history. You can also learn a lot about the modern history, or, you know, what's happening now in gold dredging, which is actually really fascinating. One of my favorite things to do in the morning was to go to it's called the Polar Cub Cafe. It's right on the Bering Strait, on Main Street. And you go, and it's nothing fancy whatsoever. And you go in there and you sit and you have your cup of coffee, and I would just listen to everyone around me. First of all, it was all men. And they were all there doing modern day gold mining, basically, and dredging. Mm-hmm. And it was fascinating to hear the stories. I would just eavesdrop the whole time, and they're talking about what they found and the season and, you know, who's doing what. And it was really cool.
Interesting.
Yeah. And, you know, the food was fine there.
I'm sort of picturing, in terms of food, the food is going to be a little expensive and the accommodations not so expensive. Am I on the right track?
No, everything is expensive.
Everything is expensive.
And I'll tell you, in all three of these towns, everything is expensive. Mm-hmm. And partially because, of course, it is quite remote and hard to get stuff to. Otherwise, though, I found all of Alaska to be on the more expensive side, even in Anchorage. And in these smaller communities, even more so. So, for example, a hotel, I stayed in the nicest hotel in town. And I say nicest kind of sarcastically. It was just a basic hotel, and it was called the Aurora Inn, and they were perfectly nice, but it was $200 a night.
Oh, wow. Okay.
And there's another hotel called Dredge Number 7. That's around $150 to $200 a night. And then there's the Nome Nugget Inn, which is probably not quite that expensive, but in that same range. There's not many places to stay. There's about three.
Okay. Okay.
That's it. And Aurora is definitely the nicest. But, you know, it's housing a lot of the workers and stuff there, too,
right.
mainly.
Mm-hmm.
There's not a ton of tourism. I think I read that it's only like 20,000 people a year in tourism.
Hmm. Okay.
So, and same with the food. The food and the drink is also fairly expensive. Surprisingly, though, the food is good. I remember, actually, one of my favorite places that I went there was a place called Twin Dragon. And I remember thinking, are you kidding me? I'm going to go to like an Asian place. No.
You're pretty close to Asia.
Well, I should have thought about that because yeah. That's true.
You can see it from there, if I recall, one of the former governors of Alaska.
Well, you just about can. But yeah, like the Twin Dragon had some of the best Vietnamese soup that I've ever had. And I lived in Vietnam. Mm-hmm. So it was great. But, you know, it's all very basic. In fact, a lot of the buildings and everything are old containers and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. Like they're very, very basic living. And all the buildings are raised off the tundra because the tundra isn't stable, obviously. So it's pretty fascinating. But my best advice, and someone gave me this advice, is if you really want to get to know Nome, at about 11 o'clock at night, go on out to one of the pubs. I went to the Board of Trade Saloon because that's where I was told that is quite an infamous bar. And just go sit there at the bar and order beer and see who you meet. And I did that one night, and I ended up closing out that bar at about 3 a.m. And it was fascinating. And I always felt safe. I was traveling alone. I always felt safe. But it was a really fascinating way to meet locals, to just kind of hear stories, to hear what it was like to live there, to see a lot of drunk people, to play some cornhole. You know, it was a little bit of everything.
Excellent. Anything else we want to talk about with Nome?
Go to the cemetery. It's one of my favorite places there. Mm. Also, one of the only places where they have trees. And if you look hard at the cemetery, you will find a cookie recipe on one of the gravestones.
What?
Yeah.
It's okay.
Pretty cool. You showed me that. Yeah, be a little scavenger hunt.
What type of cookie?
It wasn't chocolate chip. It was like snickerdoodle or something.
Oh, okay. Well, that's fair enough. Just had one of those moments ago. Not a baked Alaska recipe. Okay.
No.
Where do we head from Nome?
Then let's go north.
Okay.
I actually, and this is the direction I went, so I flew from Nome to Fairbanks. Mm-hmm. From Fairbanks, you can head north up above the Arctic Circle, because Nome isn't actually above the Arctic Circle. It's close, but if you go north of Fairbanks, you can get up above the Arctic Circle, and there's only one highway that will go there, and that's the Dalton Highway.
Right.
So you're familiar with it, obviously.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
It's the famous highway that was built for the Alaska Pipeline.
Right.
And it's also, I think, pretty famous now, too, because of TV shows. What is it? The Ice Road Truckers or something? I don't watch any of these TV shows, but everyone told me about them.
Yeah, I have not seen it, but I've heard of it.
So I was pretty excited because I wanted to go up the Dalton Highway and see what life was like above the Arctic Circle. And there's not a lot on the Dalton Highway at all. However, at mile marker 175, which is about 260 miles north of Fairbanks, is a little town called Coldfoot or Coldfoot Camp, either one. And it's basically now, it exists today, it's basically a trucker stop slash town. I don't even think I can call it a town, but there is a post office and there's an airstrip. And then there's the trucker stop.
And we should say, when you say the Dalton Highway, this is not a four-lane modern superhighway.
Nope. Once again, this is one of these things that it's hard to get here.
Yeah.
This is a dirt road that is mainly driven by truckers. It's not maintained that well. And in fact, no normal rental car company will allow you to take your own car on it. But there are ways that you can drive on it. It starts out as a paved highway, but once you get a little bit further north, it turns into just a dirt highway.
Okay.
And the day we drove it, we had really good weather, so we were lucky. Mainly all we saw were other trucks. Every car on the highway really has to have a CB system. And you actually kind of, as you go over ridges and stuff, you even call it out lots of times, which is kind of fascinating. It was fun. I basically went on a tour that took me up there. However, you can do it independently. There is one company that will actually rent you a car called Arctic Outfitters. They will rent you a car that's allowed to go on the gravel roads. It's expensive, though. You pay for it big time. So it ranges from $179 to $229 a day to rent your own car.
And how much does the tour cost by comparison?
Well, the tours can take various forms. So you can take this tour where you drive up and you can fly back, or you can fly up and fly back, or you can drive up and drive back in a tour. There's also a shuttle, the Dalton Highway Shuttle, that's like no nonsense. It's just going to shuttle you up to Coldfoot for $168 round trip. The other thing I should say about the rental car, though, is it's expensive and you have to be 30 years old to do it. They won't even rent to you.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Hmm. It comes with the CB radio, 2 spare tires, first aid kit, etc. But it does afford you to be able to do whatever you want, which is nice. And I think if I ever go again, which I hope I do, that's how I'm going to do it. But the tour was great. So the tour, Northern Alaska Tour Company, basically you're in a 13-passenger van. There were only 6 of us, though. And you have a driver, and they're educating you the whole way up there. So you're learning all these stories. You're learning about the geography, the history. You're learning all about the pipeline, which is actually really fascinating. I found it absolutely fascinating. One of the biggest engineering feats around, basically. You know, the pipeline's, 800 miles, earthquake-proof. It was really cool. And it was kind of one of these things where it's always in your sights as you're driving that highway.
Right, sure.
Always in your sights. There are a few places where it goes underground, mm-hmm. but it just kind of felt like this weird, like monkey on your back kind of thing, because it was always there, which you don't have many drives where that's the case. But yeah, so the tour is really cool, though. It stops, you have lunch, you stop at the Yukon River, you learn all about like what it's like to be a trucker on the highway, you stop at the Arctic Circle, have a little pomp and circumstance and cake if you cross over the Arctic Circle. You walk on the tundra. It was really well done and fascinating.
And you basically drove not quite halfway between the start of the highway and Prudhoe Bay.
No, because Fairbanks is really in the middle.
Oh, right. From Fairbanks to, right. But the Dalton Highway starts at Fairbanks, right?
Yeah, you're right. Yeah. So yes, about halfway. You get into Coldfoot, and Coldfoot, you know, we were talking about small remote communities, mm-hmm. and that's what I was looking for on this trip. In the 2012 census, it had a population of 10 people. But there are lots of people coming through Coldfoot because it's the truckers going every day. And there are certainly a lot of seasonal workers. There were there in the summer, obviously. But the truck stop is open year-round, as is the inn, basically, the Coldfoot camp, the motel that's associated with it, for lack of a better word. But just a little bit of history on Coldfoot. It's actually really kind of cool because the truckers actually built Coldfoot. I think it was back in, it was a dog musher. I think he might have won the Iditarod, Dick Mackey, when the Dalton Highway was built and they were building up the pipeline. He set up an old school bus at this point in Coldfoot and began selling hamburgers basically to the truck drivers. And the truckers found that it was a really good halfway point, convenient mm-hmm. stop to make. They liked it. It was a place they could stop and have some food, coffee, and relax. And so they basically started dropping off packing crates that had been used to haul the pipeline insulation. And they began building up, like this cafe, this stop, you know, so they actually built it. And in fact, one of the coolest things when you go into the truck stop, they have this center pole. And it's, you know, you can tell it was just a tree, but a center pole, it's right beside the cash register. And you can read all of their engraved names in the pole, the people who actually built the place. So that's pretty cool. And that pole is also kind of the center communication center. So when you go in there, you're going to see all kinds of like little messages tacked to it that says things like, Bob, call home. Because there's not a lot of cell phone coverage up there at all. So yeah, so it's just kind of this central communication point. It's a really cute story. But yeah, so it's a very small community. But there are actually lots of things to do there as a tourist or someone who's visiting the area. Driving up there is an adventure in and of itself. But once you're up there, I actually stayed overnight at the hotel. And the next day I went and I visited. There's a little tiny community called Wiseman. Mm-hmm. Maybe probably only about 5 or 6 people, but you can go visit that village. I actually took another guide and we drove up to Adigan Pass, which is the highest pass in mm-hmm. the Brooks Range.
The Continental Divide.
Yeah,
I think,
exactly.
Isn't it?
And it's about 4,700 feet. That's the highest point of the Dalton Highway too. And so you can, you know, get out there. And actually the day we did that, that was August, and it snowed on us. It was snowing top of the pass. So that was pretty cool. You can go on hikes all around the area. There's river rafting. You can also, as I said, there's an airstrip there. You can do flight seeing. It is some of the most beautiful mountain range and country that I've seen. It's just so unusual. Once again, you're Arctic tundra, so no trees. Everything is super spongy. But it's fascinating to even just go out and hike along it. So there's plenty to do for a day up there that you can keep yourself busy. And then, of course, there's the Chuxhop itself, which is a pretty interesting petri dish of culture. Because what it is it's truckers, it's pipeline workers who are there maintaining the pipeline, and then it's this few little handful of tourists. And so it's pretty interesting to see how they intermingle. They serve a buffet. There's no place to eat in town besides the truck stop, so they serve a buffet, which was hearty and good. I was pretty fascinated because at the truck stop, the truckers had a separate little area all to themselves. They had their own TV, and it even said truckers only. There was a little sign up there. And all I could think about is I'm like, I feel like they're the mafia. Like, I was terrified to go and speak to them, and I was scared to take a picture, but I was fascinated with them. There's plenty of food and drink. There's a little bar there. Everyone warned me, being a female traveling there alone, but I didn't have any trouble. You know, the place to stay, the Coldfoot Camp, also super expensive, probably one of the most expensive places I've ever stayed for what you get. So once again, it's $200 a night, and it's basically a hotel made out of modular housing units left over from the pipeline construction. So it's kind of like you're staying in a container. Interestingly enough, though, when they started tourism up there, I think it was Holland Cruise Lines started taking cruisers up there. They don't do it anymore. But when they did, they said, okay, these accommodations aren't going to do. You need to have private bathrooms. You need to have private bathrooms in each of these rooms. So they went to the expense and built private bathrooms in each of the little rooms. They're extremely basic, but they did it. So, you know, I had my own little room, had two twin beds, wood paneling. There was heat, warm water sometimes. Actually, when I woke up that morning, there was no water. There were mouse traps in the hallway. No mice, luckily, that I saw in the trap. I mean, it was basic, very, very basic. But it was $200 a night. I should also mention the other thing. I was just on the beginning of this. I think they were just starting these tours up there now. They do a lot of Northern Lights viewing up there, too. But I was a little early for it. But lots of times they'll do like a trip from Fairbanks to, once again, kind of do the tour up there by van. You stay overnight in Coldfoot at the inn and do aurora viewing and then fly back the next day. So that's a fun option. Yeah. So really quirky little stop, beautiful scenery, plenty of things to do, an environment that you've never seen before, and truckers. It's fun.
Well, and my impression from what you're saying is the drive-fly option might be a good option because as beautiful as it was all the same on the way back. So
yeah. I mean, yeah, it would have been hard. It's certainly cheaper to do the drive-drive.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, you're in Alaska too. Bush planes and those flights aren't that expensive, and it's a beautiful way to get around. That's how I got around to a lot of these communities. I mean, the scenery is just stunning. So it's worth it.
Excellent.
Yeah.
And then we have one more stop.
Yes. McCarthy. Have you ever heard of McCarthy?
McCarthy I've not heard of.
I'm surprised. I'm only surprised because there's a lot of, well, there's some history there, some tragic history there too. Have you heard of, I hope you've heard of Wrangell St. Elias National Park?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So McCarthy is a town surrounded by Wrangell St. Elias National Park. And it Wrangell St. Elias is the largest national park in the United States, which is kind of an interesting little fact that I thought you probably knew. Maybe not. I have no idea.
I think I have heard that, but I did not remember that.
Yeah. The little trivia piece that I kept seeing was that Wrangell St. Elias, it's 13.2 million acres. You can fit Switzerland, Yellowstone, and Yosemite National Park in its borders.
Huh.
It's huge. And the cool thing, there are two roads in the whole park. Two. So you're talking remote park. And the two roads, of course, are not maintained well. They're dirt roads, you know. And once again, most rental companies will never let you take a car on them. It's a beautiful, beautiful park. But McCarthy itself, let's see, in a 2010 census, there were 28 people that lived in McCarthy. So once again, very small town. Surrounded by national park, I think it's one of the only towns in a national park. But it has an interesting history. In 1900, copper was discovered in the area, and a mining business popped up called Kennecott Mining Company. And after that, they basically built a mining town and they called it Kennecott. So Kennecott is still there today. It's all abandoned. And that's one of the cool things kind of you can do around the area is visit the Kennecott mines. But Kennecott town and mines was a booming industry for years. And of course, in the mining town or in Kennecott, they forbid alcoholic beverages and basically any kind of fun.
Because it's a company town.
Yes. Okay. And so all of that was forbidden. And of course, what happens? The town of McCarthy grew up next door as the area to provide all those in-demand services that weren't available in the company town. So there was booze, there was gambling, there was prostitution. It was like everything you would imagine, right? All the fun. And that actually went on. Those two towns kind of, they lived like that for a long time. Everyone knew that people went to McCarthy to go have fun. And then you came back to work in Kennecott. They were only, I think it's only like 5 miles apart. They're very close. Then in 1938, the copper mining really kind of dried up and became uneconomical. The rail line shut down. Everything shut down there. And so McCarthy kind of dried up in a way. Yeah, there were a few diehards out there yet. In 1980, that's when Wrangell St. Elias was actually named a national park. And that started to kind of bring back or bring in some of this kind of adventure tourism. And so the few people that were in McCarthy started providing like adventure tours and some facilities and stuff to tourists. But it's still super, super small. And it's kind of cool because as you walk through Main Street, which is once again just a gravel road riddled with potholes, and I think there's actually one other gravel road that goes through the town. I mean, there's not much there. There's a saloon. There's a little market that you can get like packed lunches from. The saloon is also a restaurant. And then there's this place called Ma Johnson's Hotel. And Ma Johnson's was an old saloonish, you know, hotel back in the day, and it's been really kind of refurbished and brought back to its original state, which is really cute. So it's kind of like you're walking through this old West town, you know, on a dirt road. You've got saloons, you've got an old lodge. It's really cute. And the people there are really quirky. There's lots of little cabins, run-down cabins, basically. And I learned this kind of all over Alaska, but dry cabins. Do you know what a dry cabin is?
I do not know what a dry cabin is.
Very important to know in remote Alaska. Dry cabin does not have plumbing. So,
okay. All right.
So I talked to a number of people that had to do like water runs that day because they live in dry cabins and they live there year round. It's really pretty fascinating. So, you know, McCarthy is pretty simple, but it's a place to kind of go and relax. Strangely though, they did have a really good cell phone connection, which was very odd. Out of all these towns that I talked about, they were the only ones, and they were probably the most remote. So that was strange. But, you know, as far as how to get there, once again, you've got a few choices. McCarthy Air is a little bush plane flight. I think they have 3 daily flights. That's how I got out there and back. And I will tell you, if you can splurge, it's not that expensive, but if you can do that, it is a beautiful flight. It's one of the most stunning flights I ever went on because you're basically flying over Wrangell St. Elias National Park.
Which looked like it had a number of glaciers from what I was seeing on the map.
Yes, that's just what I was going to say. Glacial lakes, you've got multiple glaciers that you're flying over. You can see all these abandoned mines up in the mountains. You've got a ton of, you know, 18,000, you know, 15,000 to 18,000 foot peaks that you're flying next to. It was jaw-dropping. And one of the best days, I actually just wrote about this day because it was one of my best
days of your life is what I think you called it on your website I saw.
Yeah. The whole drive, I actually drove from Anchorage out to the airport where you catch the McCarthy Air flight. And that drive from Anchorage out there was also stunning, full of glaciers and stuff. But then I got on the plane and it got even better. Like, it was just crazy. So fun little flight. You can get out there that way. You can also drive on the gravel road, McCarthy Road, basically. It's 61 miles and it starts in a little town called Chitina and it follows the river and it'll take you about 3 hours on that road, assuming it's not raining or something like that. And there are about 3 different car companies that you can actually rent from that will allow you to drive. It's not Hertz and Avis.
Right, sure. Yeah.
You know, they're smaller. And
it's Bob's rental car. And
pretty much. Yeah. But you can do that. There are also a few shuttles. They take much longer.
So you're really just saying Bob will let you use his car.
Yes. For a nice fee. But lots of people do drive out there because, I mean, you are going into a national park too. So there's camping, you can camp and stuff like that. But, and I think it would be a really fun way to go. Now, since I've done the flight, I think it would be fun to do like a flight in and a drive out or something like that to kind of really get a feel for the area. So you, that's, I mean, there's a few ways to get there. Once you're there in the town, there's a whole bunch of things to do. I mean, you're at the footsteps of, or, you know, at the, right at the national park. So you, there's a ton of things to do. One of the things I did, which was really fun, is I did a full day glacier hike. There's a really great operation there called the St. Elias Alpine Guides. They've been in operation for a long time. And they do all kinds of like super adventure tours, half days, full days, multi-days. So one of the things they do is they'll take you out on the Ross Glacier. And it just so happened that it was just me and a guide. Like, there was no one else that signed up for the full-day hike. So I had all day just wandering around the glacier. We had lunch out there. It was super fun. You can also do ice climbing. The Alpine guides will also do multi-day big hiking trips. They also support the real climbers who are out there trying to summit the high peaks and stuff like that. So they'll get you to the base camps and stuff like that. But the backcountry hiking, I think, would be really cool. If I ever go back again, I would love to do that with them. You go out for like 3 or 4 days over glaciers, camp in the wilderness, et cetera. There's also river rafting you can do there. You can hike to the old mines, which is I would have loved to do. I ran out of time. And you can also take, I mentioned this earlier, a tour of the Kennecott Mine.
That would be fascinating.
It is fascinating. And it's really picturesque, too.
Now, I normally picture a copper mine as an open pit mine, but my impression here is that this is not. This is a underground mine.
I honestly don't know.
Okay.
Because what we actually toured was the facility in which they brought it all back to.
Mm-hmm. The processing plant.
Yes. So I couldn't see, we didn't actually go into the mountains to see where they were mining, but it was mountain. I mean, they were in the mountains, but they had a whole intricate like pulley system and so on to get the stuff back to be processed. And so we went through all the buildings that processed it and how they broke it down.
It is apparently an open pit mine. While you were talking, I looked it up and it is a large open pit mine.
Yeah. So in the mines, you know, the learning about how they processed it all and what life was like in the mining town and stuff like that is really fascinating. It was a cute, Kennecott is a cute little town. It's much more pristine in a way than McCarthy. McCarthy still has that old kind of saloon feel, you know, Wild West feel.
Okay.
Kennecott is a little bit more set up for tourism.
Doesn't have that old saloon smell, does it?
No. Well, I don't know. You know, talking about where you can stay in the area too, Kennecott is one of the areas where you can stay. They have a very nice, it's called Kennecott Glacier Lodge. It's a little bit more high end. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, 100-some rooms. And in fact, what I found is that it seemed like there were a lot of people that had done packages where they fly out through Wrangell Air and they just go to Kennecott Lodge. They stay overnight. They do a tour, maybe on the glacier, maybe of the mine, and then they fly back. That's kind of the normal tourism turn, but I did that differently. I flew out. I went and stayed in McCarthy at Ma Johnson's Hotel because that was so cool. And then I did a couple days of stuff and then flew back. But, you know, if you want a little bit more upscale experience, you can go to the Kennecott Glacier Lodge. There's a whole dining area there. But where I stayed at Ma Johnson's was really cool. It was really cute. They actually, as I got my initial welcoming into the hotel, they told me that they don't have any electrical plugs in the room, not only to stay true to the history, but mainly because they think it makes people more social to have to sit in the common areas and interact, which I loved. It was really cute. And it was really an old, old building and hotel. And it was all had all this old artifacts in it. The owner, Neil, who I met and talked to, he has this love of collecting old antiques and the history. And you could tell that he put a lot of time into it. Reminded me a lot of my grandmother's house. And it's the Ma Johnson's. It doesn't have any en-suite bathrooms. It's all shared bathrooms and just rooms. There's no keys. They don't have any keys for the rooms. No need to have them.
Okay.
Yeah. There's also a backpacker hostel, also run by Neil, the same guy who owns Ma Johnson's. Hmm. So a little bit cheaper option because Ma Johnson's, once again, was around $200.
Right.
You know, and you didn't get a bathroom either. So, and then, of course, there are campgrounds in the park that you can stay at, too. You don't go to any of these places, really, for the food. You know, food is just sustenance, in my opinion, in lots of these remote places, except for that one Asian place I went to in Nome. That was good. But McCarthy, you can eat at the lodge or the saloon. I think it was Thursday nights. I don't know if it was Wednesday or Thursday now. They have open mic nights, and you got to go to that because that's where you really meet the locals. It's awesome. And there was another little tiny place called Potato Head that was basically a little kind of food truck with Mr. Potato Heads that you could play with while you were waiting for your food. It was cute, very basic food, but it's also a place where you can get a real proper cup of coffee, like a latte or cappuccino. And that was in McCarthy. And then the grocery store will make sack lunches for you. And other than that, someone told me there was some pizza food truck by the river, but I never found it. So who knows? But, you know, your options are limited, but it's just fun. I love to be in places like that where everything's just kind of stripped down and basic and the people are real. And it was a great, great time.
Excellent. We probably need to start wrapping this up. Before I get to my last four questions, Sherry, anything else we need to know before we head out to remote Alaska?
I hope that some of this inspired some people to, you know, really get beyond the cruises and get out there and see some of these other parts of Alaska and meet people. The people are so, so nice, and you'll make friends and it'll be full of great stories to tell.
Well, this one's a little different in the sense that we're not necessarily talking about a 1 week trip that you would do all together.
Yes.
This right. might in fact be something that you would add one of these onto your other trip to Alaska. You know, you're up to see Denali, or you're even, you know, doing a land portion of a cruise and then go and see one of these potentially at a time. But it seemed like a real good thematic, and you could do them all in a week if you wanted to.
You could do them all in a week if you wanted to. You'd have to do the flying options on all
of
them.
You would have to do the
Yeah, you'd have to be quick. Yep. But you could do it. And I agree with you 100%. Like even if people think of this as I'm taking this cruise, but I want to do a little bit inland, you know, here are three really good options that you can choose from that will show you a whole different side of Alaska. And so, you know, you just kind of figure out which one might fit your personality best.
Excellent. Last four questions. You're standing in the prettiest spot you saw in Alaska. Where are you standing and what are you looking at?
I am standing on Ross Glacier, looking at miles and miles of ice, blue, beautiful ice, surrounded by 18,000 foot peaks.
I was so sure from looking at your pictures that that's where we're going to be.
Well, yeah, my actual answer would be I'm seeing that from above, from the plane, because that's
right,
pretty
sure.
Amazing.
I expected that, actually. One thing that makes you laugh and say only in rural Alaska, besides the cookie recipe on the...
Oh, that was pretty cool. I would say, do you get to actually like play with CB radios again? They replace your cell phones and you get to learn what a dry cabin is. You actually use the words dry cabin and know what they are.
And did you have a CB handle now that you've been in rural Alaska on the Dalton Highway here?
I wish so. I tell you what, I don't. But I tell you what, next time I go and I go on the Dalton Highway and I rent my own car, you'll be damn sure that I'm going to have a CB handle.
Well, we can reach out to our community here. If you have a suggestion for a CB handle for Sherry, leave it as a comment on this episode and we'll pass that along. Make sure she's ready next time she goes up there.
I love it.
Finish this thought. You really know you're in rural Alaska when...
You're paying $200 for a hotel that has mouse tracks, hallway, and police wake-up calls.
Wait, what was the last part?
The police wake-up calls. I didn't tell you about that. Yeah. There were a few times where police were knocking on, not on my door, thank God, on people's doors across the hallway.
Okay.
It's a rough and tumble area sometimes.
Okay. Got it. It wasn't an official wake-up call that they had placed, in
no,
other words.
Okay. No, it was more like a, ma'am, open up, this is the police.
Well, and so. And apparently sometimes they weren't even keys, so they really could have just walked in if they wanted to.
Yes. But seriously, I don't want to scare people away. I mean, that's the fun part of it. I was, like I said, I traveled solo the whole way through these towns. I never had a problem.
Well, and you have traveled in scarier places than remote Alaska, yeah.
Yeah.
So, and if you don't believe me, go listen to the show that we did with Sherry on traveling solo as a woman that you have now been doing for how many years?
9 years.
9 years. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Excellent. And last question. Summarize the trip in just three words.
Wild.
Okay.
For the wildlife. Mm-hmm. Rugged and bright. Because I was, summertime. It wasn't quite midnight sun, but... It was a lot of sun.
And you say wildlife. Did we talk about any wildlife?
We didn't. Well, we did a little about the birding in Nome.
Okay. Yeah.
But also in Nome, you'll find easy to find, like the reindeer's musk oxen.
Okay.
Musk oxen are really fascinating. They're like these ancient looking buffaloes. Mm-hmm. Like, I really didn't think they were real at first. And you'll find them all over Nome. Nome was a good place for wildlife.
Excellent. Well, Sherry, thanks so much for coming back on the show. Where can people read more about your travels? And is there a great article on Alaska that they can read there?
Yes, of course. So they can find me on otsworld.com, OTTSWORLD.com. And yes, there are a few articles on Alaska there right now. If they just go to the destination section and find Alaska, you'll see them. But I'm actually going to be writing extensively about all of this at the beginning of the year, probably in February. There'll be all the articles out there.
Excellent.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for coming on Amateur Traveler and sharing with us your love for Alaska.
Thank you.
I mentioned at the beginning that I was going to ask you for a favor, and that's to fill out the survey for PodTrack, which is the company that I'm working with to sell ads for the Amateur Traveler. I picked the shorter version of the PodTrack survey. I would love to know all the information from the longer version, but I assume you, like me, are pretty busy. But I would really appreciate your help with that. You can find that at amateurtraveler.com/survey2. With that, we're going to end this episode of The Amateur Traveler. If you have any questions, send an email to host@amateurtraveler.com, or better yet, leave a comment on this episode at amateurtraveler.com. You can follow me on Pinterest, Instagram, or Twitter as Chris2X. And as always, thanks so much for listening. I got to see one more cathedral. I got to sit in one more cafe. I know that I should be heading home.